first teacher that I sat longer retreats with, Dhiravamsa, who I mentioned had been a Thai man, had been a monk for many years. And I'll just thought I'd share with you something that that he said. I remember him saying about being. He ordained. He was very young. He was a teenager, and he was a novice. So, as a young monk, and he shared this story. So he was at a monastery, and one day somebody came up to him and said, the abbot wants to see you. And this was not usual. So what it seems was Dhiravamsa was going to get tested on his understanding so far. So maybe I'll just suggest you make a little kind of a mind experiment here, a thought experiment of that you're a young monk or nun being called in front of the abbot or the abbess, and you're going to get tested. Don't worry, I won't ask you the answer, but just try to imagine how you would respond to these questions. So the first question, not so hard. So the abbot took a scarf and kind of waved it in the air. And he said, do you see the scarf? So pretty easy, right? And Dhiravamsa said, yes. Now came the more difficult question. Who sees? So just take a moment to reflect on that question. Who sees the scarf? Who sees? And what kind of answer you would come up with? So Dhiravamsa on the spot, he has to, I'll share with you how he answered the question. Is he said, chitta. He said, chitta. So he answered using a Pali word, and it might also be a Thai word. I'm not sure of that, but he answered using this Pali word, which is a bit hard to translate, but it's often translated as mind heart. And a mind heart sees. And what a quality of this mind heart is that it arises because of different conditions. So it's not a permanent kind of entity that sees. That's what I take from that answer. So this chitta, mind, heart, arises because of other conditions. Now I'm going to maybe suggest another possible answer to the question, which I think would be compatible, and that would be consciousness sees. And we had a little demonstration this morning talking about consciousness. And in this case, it's a very particular type of consciousness, which is called sight consciousness. And in these teachings, there's of dependent origination. There's 12 links around this cycle. I've already mentioned two of the links, ignorance and suffering. So this will be filling in three more links, because there's consciousness would be one of the links, and then sight, or one of the sense organs, as well as included in that link is the sense object. So the eye and the scarf would be considered part of that sense space. So another link. And when they meet, that is called contact. So that would be another link. So in the Buddhist description of this kind of phenomena of seeing, there's three things arise at the very same time. And that would be the sense base, kind of the sense organ with the sense object. That's considered one. Consciousness is considered another. And contact is considered another. So that's the three of these links. And these arise together. And then there's a lot happens after we get when this arises, this consciousness of sight. So so that's just a different way of maybe understanding this kind of phenomena of, say, perceiving and perception, as opposed to our normal sense is okay, or perhaps the wrong answer to that little test that the abbot gave to Dhiravamsa was, well, I see that. I see the scarf. So that was the failing answer. So I think Dhiravamsa got the pass on that one. And so what I'd like to do at this point, so that I'll describe this, the 12 links. But as a way of getting into that, there's a handout here. So maybe we can pass those around. And this is, I put up a couple of posters, and on the one side of the handout is a black and white version of something similar to this poster, which is called The Wheel of Life. I've got more of those if we need more. We need a couple on the back there. Okay, does everyone have one now? Need one more? Okay, great. So it's a little hard to see some of these things. You can, at another time, great. You can look at these posters as well. So I'd like to just, this is one kind of depiction of, which is called the Wheel of Life or the Wheel of Samsara. And again, it's a little hard to see with this reproduction. But I would just like to describe some of these elements here that are shown as, because this kind of lets us know some of the different elements from this teaching that are incorporated into this teaching of dependent origination. To start with, this kind of scary looking character who's holding this circle, his name is Yama. But maybe I'll start with this circle, actually, that Yama is holding. And in some depictions, this is considered to be a mirror. So we're looking in a mirror. And this mirror can show our life or perhaps the world. And by the way, if you have any questions or comments as I'm presenting, please just jump in. Any thoughts? So now back to Yama, who is an interesting character. So apparently, when you die, according to this kind of teachings, this is who you meet. So it's a little different than maybe St. Peter, you know. But I don't, as Yama is portrayed, he's not really a bad guy. He's just, he's actually from one of the god realms. And he's got this unfortunate day job of being kind of guardian of the lower worlds. So one place I saw him described, well, he's kind of like a cosmic bureaucrat, enforcing the laws of karma. And apparently, just so you've got a heads up, he asks you a question when you get to wherever he is. And so his question is, by the way, I sent you some messengers. Have you profited by them? And so if you say, messengers? Like, what messengers? Apparently that's the wrong answer. Because then you kind of get sent to an undesirable place. But if you say, yes, I noticed your messengers and I've lived my life accordingly, then you go to a better destination. And these messengers are old age, sickness, and death, just as in the story of the Buddha, which kind of reflections on these messengers was the beginning of the Buddha's spiritual journey. Okay, so we'll move on from Yama. Yama kind of looks like some of the Tibetan images that you see, some of these. So in the very center is actually three animals. There's a pig and a rooster and a snake. And they seem to be even like kind of devouring each other in this circle. And these represent greed, aversion, delusion, these three animals. And they're kind of devouring each other, kind of connected to each other. And let's see. So the pig is the delusion, snake is the aversion, and the rooster is the greed. So I would take it, this being at the center, this is a bit of a kind of a driver to this cycle. And then just outside of that ring where we've got half of it's in dark, half of it's in light, we've got a human kind of going, I think, through their life, going through from one realm to another. The rise and fall of beings passing from one world and arising in another, which we can remember that's one of the insights, the knowledges that the Buddha got from his, on the night of his awakening. Now, if we go a little further out from there, we have six different areas in this circle. And these represent different realms in Buddhist cosmology. So I just like to, so these are the realms that we would pass in and out of. And there's, maybe just now I'll mention that there are two different ways of interpreting dependent origination. And different people have different views on this. So it's not you kind of a unanimous understanding. And the two different kind of views are that one is, and when I first heard these teachings, I heard terms like birth, rebirth, or birth and death. So I thought, oh, well, this is talking about this idea of, okay, one dies and then rebirth. And that would be one interpretation, that through a cycle, that as one cycles through, one is, it actually dies and then is reborn in a different realm according to one's karma. So the other interpretation is this is actually happening all the time, moment to moment. And these different realms are what we experience moment to moment. The second way of looking at that, that's how I'm going to mainly approach this today, because I think that's how we can really experience this. If we kind of look throughout a day, we experience different mind states, and we are always coming into contact with different sense objects, different through different senses. So that's how I will approach it. But I've heard different teachers on different times talk about it in one way, and another time they talk about it in the other way. And both versions, I think, would be supported in the suttas as well. So perhaps the Buddha was being intentionally kind of not specific about this. So any thoughts about that, like this sort of two different ways? Yeah. Mm-hmm. After a physical death?
For me, it's
for yes, that's how you would, that's what makes sense to you. Yeah. I mean, that's what makes sense to me, too, because that's what I can experience. You know, I haven't gone into a state where I've seen past lives or beings dying and being reborn. But that's not to say... my own view of that is, well, I haven't experienced that, but I'm not going to dismiss it. And what I've heard Sharon Salzberg say when she's asked this, she said something like, well, you know, the Buddha was right about the suffering thing, so maybe he's right about that too. So I just thought I'd talk about a little bit these different realms. Here. So the very top is the God realm, and I think at the Buddha's time there was all kinds of different cosmologies present, and I think the Buddha just kind of said, oh, I can talk about things in terms of that kind of language as well, but with a different point of view. So this is the God realm, and in Buddhist cosmology, there's many different God realms. Looks pretty nice. Seems like there's musicians entertaining us, and something that suspiciously looks like a hot tub. Somebody's flying, and you know, apparently one is reborn there, and you're there for a long time. Time is maybe different as we understand it, but long periods of time. However, the difference, I think, when the Buddha referred to this. He said, and this would be different than, say, a Christian view of heaven, is he said, it too is temporary. You still come out of that. So it is, you have not escaped what's called samsara, or all the cycles of suffering. And it's, if you come down from that kind of beautiful place, then it must be quite shocking if you enter, say, the human realm or some of the lower realms from there. And then moving around to clockwise, we see, looks like some beings on horseback, and they're kind of fighting each other. And so this is the jealous god realm, or Asura realm. Apparently, there. I thought this was an interesting story. There's, in this cosmology, there's a mountain, and as you get more refined, you go up, these god realms go up the mountain, and these certain. So these gods were in this certain realm, partway up the mountain, pretty good place. And some of the gods started kind of acting out, misbehaving. And the other gods kind of decided they weren't going to take it anymore. And they gathered up these mischievous, misbehaving beings or gods and tossed them off the mountain. And those became the Asuras. And ever since, they're called the jealous god realms. They get into fights with this realm trying to get back in. So that's the fighting. In our human realm, I kind of see in different areas, like there would be kind of examples that might resonate with us. The Conrad Blacks, the rock stars who can only talk about themselves. So the political leaders who have a very self-centered perspective. So movie stars also might be just very self-centered and always trying to prove themselves and draw attention to themselves. That's how I'd view this if we take this down to the human realm. One thing I'll point out in this depiction, there's a little circle or an oval in each of these realms, and there's a Buddha figure in each realm. And I think the Buddha figure is trying to enlighten that realm, the beings in that realm. There's also a tree in this Asura realm, and I've heard it called the wishing tree. So it seems maybe they're fighting over this as well. So if we keep moving around, we go into the animal realm. And these would be considered lower realms from the human realm. So the animal realm, which is characterized by, I think, more instinctual energies. Getting enough food, reproducing, just surviving. And not understanding as well is kind of characterized that realm. And if we move around, this at the very bottom, this is the hell realm. So it looks like quite an unpleasant place. Instead of a hot tub, it's kind of yeah. So I think there's various versions of hell. Some of them are very hot, some of them are very cold, And very uncomfortable, just suffering that to the extent that it would be very hard to come out of that into a balanced state of mind. And if we move around a little further, keep going clockwise, this is would be called the hungry ghost realm. So these beings are thirsty, hungry, have very narrow throats, and can never take in enough food or drink to satisfy them. There's a Gabor Mate who deals with the people who are addicted, drug addicts on the Lower East Side. He's a medical doctor. He wrote a book called In the Realm of the Hungry Ghost. So he was referring to this and talking about addiction. And this once Thich Nhat Hanh was asked by some of his students if he could describe the hungry ghost realm, you know, more clearly for them so they would understand it. And then he said, "Oh, it's like America." So if it's like America, it's probably like Canada too. And then we, coming around, we come to the human realm. And some of the images there are, it looks like maybe I see a person with a cane, maybe referring to old age or sickness. And so apparently, to be in the human realm, it's assumed that one is keeping the five precepts. If one is not keeping the five precepts, one is in a lower realm. So if one engages in harmful killing and stealing, all breaking all the precepts, then one actually isn't inhabiting the human realm. And it is said that from the human realm, it is the best place to transcend the wheel of suffering or the wheel of samsara, because it's balanced, where suffering is not so intense that we can't practice and investigate and hear teachings of liberation. So that's just a very brief description of this realm, this Buddhist cosmology. Yeah.
What's happening in the very lower right-hand corner of the
human? Yeah. Looks like a little bit like a roof over. I actually don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what some of these pictures depict. And there seems to be a little building, maybe that. Yeah, I would just be guessing. But that's our realm. That's where that's the birth we took. Yeah?
It's like somebody meditating on top, right?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Speak to the figures of the Buddha in each of the sections of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm. It's true, and they are significant, and I'm actually not sure of the significance. Obviously, in the very top, he's playing a musical instrument, like some kind of lute instrument, and I've heard that kind of that something to do with the sound is important there. And since how the Buddha taught was through speech, that was a sound of teachings. So I think that would represent some teachings. In the next one, I understand, and I don't know them all, but in the next one, in the Asura realm, I think he has a sword which has flames on it, and that would represent wisdom rather than the swords of destruction. And I'm not sure, at the very bottom in the Hell realm, it looks like he has some kind of fire. So now there is fire in the Hell realm, so I wonder if he's taking some of these images and kind of turning them to become just like the sword of destruction became the sword of wisdom. Maybe some of the elements from the realm get transformed into some kind of means for liberation. It might, I wonder in the hungry ghost realm if he has a bowl with some sustenance in it. That's, yeah, as far as I don't know the symbols in the other. And these are kind of what someone has taken from some of the teachings of the Buddha, from the suttas, their similes, and made a representation from them. So these don't go all the way back. I don't think the Buddha had a depiction like this of the Wheel of Life, but there is all kinds of descriptions in the suttas that different people have made a representation of. And in fact, some of the pictures in the Wheels of Life will be different. For example, that one comes from a website called Arrow River from a monastery in Ontario. Yeah, around Thunder Bay. It's a great website, and they had some information about the dependent origination. So, and they had this nifty picture, and you could click on any of the elements, and it gives you a little description of from that. So I'm going to go on to then. Let's see, the very outer circle is then the elements of dependent origination, and I've just put a numbers beside, and then there's a little list of numbers down on the right and left. And I'll describe, go in to those in a little more detail. And there's similes associated with each one, and I'll talk about those a little bit as well, because I think that's a useful way of kind of getting a sense of what is meant by these different, these would be called links in the cycle of dependent origination. I just wanted to talk just a little bit in general, a couple of things about samsara, a couple of quotes. This is from Christina Feldman. When all of these cycles of feeling, thought, bodily sensation, all of these cycles of mind and body, action and movement are taking place upon a foundation of ignorance, that's called samsara. And there's a poem that Heather often quotes called Natural Great Peace by Sogyal Rinpoche. Rest in natural great peace. This exhausted mind, beaten senseless by karma and neurotic thought, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the ocean of samsara, rest in natural great peace. So I'll start to talk a little bit about the actual links now. And in the And this kind of cycle, it is said to be beginningless. It doesn't start anywhere. So it's a little bit arbitrary where you start. But most people tend to, when they're describing these different links, will start with ignorance, which is kind of at the very top. If we think of this as a clock, so it's at 12 o'clock. And the simile here is actually a blind man with a cane. And sometimes there are indications that there might be a Buddha figure in some of the depictions of the Wheel of Life, and the Buddha is kind of indicating, okay, go that way, but the blind person is going the wrong way, is going in exactly the wrong direction. And bear in mind, these are all translations of Pali terms. So ignorance, the way we commonly use it, kind of might have a derogatory implication to it. Something wrong with you, you don't know this. And that's not the case in the way that the Buddha taught. It's just a simple not knowing. So a distortion of understanding truth, or not seeing reality as it really is. So my favorite description of ignorance is from Ajahn Chah. So he says, you are riding a horse. You keep asking people, where's my horse? So as long as ignorance is present, we still expect to find an experience that's completely satisfying, and we are disappointed when that is not the case. We can have a distortion of what's called the three characteristics. So we can take the unsatisfactory to be satisfactory. We can take what's impermanent to be permanent. And then the idea of self to be an enduring permanent entity, when in fact there is no such thing to be found. And it would equate to, if we view the Eightfold Path, it would equate to wrong view as opposed to right view, and not understanding the Four Noble Truths. So the Buddha said that beings hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving are bound to the cycles of samsara. So these two elements, these two links, he says, what keeps us bound to suffering, or we are hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. So those are two of the links. Any thoughts about ignorance? It's actually quite a bit to this. I started making a few notes, and so my heading was brief description of ignorance, and it kind of went on and on. Sometimes it might seem that this is a kind of a cycle that you kind of go from one to the next to the next to the next, kind of like if you made a circle of dominoes and you kind of click one over and they kind of all fell. But if we take this link of ignorance, it really affects every single link, everything else in this cycle. So the next link, if we are moving around clockwise, is I've called it formations. Sometimes they're called volitional formations, sometimes activities. And the simile is a potter. So this is a potter, and the potter is making pots, and there's a few pots that are already made beside the potter. And some of the pots will be well made, and some of the pots will be poorly made. So this is a symbolized activity. The Pali term is sankhara. It's a big, big term, like anything that's made from something else, which is actually everything. But it's called volitional sankhara, volitional activities. So it's based on something, and here it's can be based on wisdom or ignorance. So I would like to do something. I would like to borrow something from Taoism to look at this quality. So I'd like to do with you the two kind of beginning movements from Tai Chi. My first meditation teacher, he was a meditation teacher and he was a Tai Chi teacher. So he would talk about this, and it seemed to me to be relevant because let's just try this. So you can keep, you can do this sitting or standing. I think I'll stand up. And so sometimes in Taoism, they would just make a big circle. And that was referred to as, it had a term, wuji. And then, and that's represented by the very initial stance when doing Tai Chi. And then when movement starts, then it becomes the yin-yang symbol. All of a sudden, there is then opposites created. And one of those would be self, another, or could be represented by some activity. So just to start with, where this is represented by, okay, it's just a circle. This is a kind of a non-doing. So we're just present. Experiencing whatever we're experiencing, but we're just in a state of being. We're not doing anything. Just a state of being. Sometimes it's represented we're standing or connected with the earth, with our lower body, and connected to heaven with our upper body. But a state non-activity, but aliveness and being. Now, on your next in-breath, just raise the arms in front of the body. Bring them in a little bit and put them down. So now a motion is introduced. In-breath, arms coming up. Out-breath, arms coming back down. One more time. Breathing in, arms coming up. Out, arms coming down. And if one was practicing Tai Chi, one would be going, moving into all the different movements at that point. So that just represents the initial stance of, okay, just being, and then there's initial doing as we start the initial movement, moving from that depiction of just a circle to then the yin-yang symbol, where all of a sudden there's some activity, which means that there's up, down, left, right, self, other, and that is one way of viewing this volitional formations. We've started a volitional activity. Okay, so we can sit down again. So the thing about volitional activity is that that creates habit patterns, can create karma, and it all depends on what it's based on.
So, Rob, what is the difference between volitional activities and karma itself?
Mm-hmm. Well, another definition of karma is action. So I think that if you put together volition in front of the action, then you'd have some kind of equivalent. When Ajahn Suchito talks about this, he talks about kind of like more in a habit. So one does these activities more often, and it becomes a habit. So I think one could say they're the same thing or just very closely connected. But the important thing is kind of where does this action or activity come from? What's it based on? So actually there's a quote from Ajahn Suchito, and he talks about this a lot in the book Kama and the End of Kama. But from that book, he says, it's not so much that I create Kama, but that Kama creates me. To put this another way, action becomes habitual activity and then starts to form our identity. And also remember from the simile that these pots might be well made, or they might be poorly made. And the other aspect to that simile is that we know that the pots are impermanent. They will eventually break. So they are not lasting. They're not permanent. One thing comes to mind in terms of how we're creating things. As I met a woman who's from the former Yugoslavia, and she grew up there and then had moved out of Yugoslavia, was either living in Sweden or England. And after all the turmoil, and she identified herself as being Yugoslavian. So after all the turmoil in Yugoslavia, at a certain point she receives a letter from some official letter saying, as of a certain date, your Yugoslavian passport's no longer valid because Yugoslavia doesn't exist anymore. And you now have to choose between six different nationalities what you're going to be. And I'm not sure that I can name all the six, but it's like Croatian, Serbian, Bosnia, yeah, Serbo, so all of a sudden, and she didn't really identify 100% with any of those because she, you know, had family from different groups. She lived here, she lived there, she had neighbors who were this or that. You know, finally she had to decide, but she decided to become Serbian. But it was, it seemed like kind of from her point of view, all of a sudden what she was vanished, and all of a sudden there were six more things. And she had to, as being part of this world and needing a passport, she had to decide. So that to me is one example of something that's kind of created. We just kind of made it up. So sankharas are creations and energetic activity that when based on a foundation of ignorance gives fuel to the spinning of the wheel, this wheel of samsara. The next link is the link of consciousness, which we talked about a little bit. And the simile here, we had the magic show simile, but there's another simile, which is a monkey grasping after a branch. But actually, in this simile, the monkey's moving through a forest of trees, going from branch to branch to branch to branch. So that symbolizes just as, in consciousness, it's said that there's six types of consciousness, depending on six senses. So our five regular senses, and the mind is actually considered a sense, or cognizing thought is considered a sense. So when one is, it's said that consciousness, just you can't have more than one consciousness at any one time. So as we make contact with something, like Dhiravansa and the scarf and his eyes, that sight consciousness arises. And then you see something else, that disappears, that next consciousness arises, then the next consciousness arises, we hear something, that when we think something, that's the next consciousness. So that's symbolized by this, I grasp one branch, then I grasp another branch. I can't just keep holding on to the previous branch when I go for the next branch. So kind of going through life, contact, different consciousness all the time. But our misperception is, consciousness is where I reside because I am seeing this, and then I am seeing that, and then I am seeing that. But in these teachings, it said that, that just arises, that just arises, that just arises. Just like the with a scarf, three things arise at the same time. The eye, seeing, the object, the contact, and consciousness. Those three things coming together at the same time. And another part of consciousness is that it can be colored by then by ignorance, or by those three elements at the very center of the circle: greed, hatred, delusion, or greed, aversion, delusion. And it's not an objective kind of experience. So just imagine we all walked around the house, and what we would notice would vary from person to person, depending on what our inclinations were. We might be interested in, say, architecture, and we might be looking at the house. We might be interested in plants, and we might be looking at different plants. So different people would do the exact same thing, walk around the house, and have a totally different experience. And different things would arise in the consciousness in different ways. So where we might think, this is objective, it's not actually, in fact, objective. It's conditioned by different things. There's a book I looked at by Jay Ingram, who I think is sometimes on CBC, called, and it's a book on consciousness, and not from a Buddhist perspective at all. He's looking at more modern kinds of research. And he refers to consciousness as the grand illusion. And I'm not sure that he was aware of the Buddha's simile, the magic show. But I'm quite interested when, from two completely different perspectives, one comes to the same conclusion. Yeah, Helen. Yep, that's correct. Yep. So it doesn't carry on from one moment to the next. But our impression is not really that. We don't really see that. We might see that if we are getting deeper into, say, a concentrated state and just seeing more of the impermanent nature of our perception. We might experience that. Oh, yeah, that's right.
So if you just look at the film itself on the old reels, you see the frame.
Yeah.
And the illusion of continuity.
That's right, yeah. Or those old-fashioned little booklets, and you kind of flip through them, and there's a little image of somebody doing something. Similar kind of, yeah. But it looks like when we see the film and we get involved in it, or we're scared, or... that it is continuous, but it is individual frames. Yeah. So that is a different way of looking at our experience. And then if we move on, one thing I'll just mention is the outer ring where we have these similes do not correspond to... Oh, if we're at consciousness, that must be something to do with the jealous. That's independent. So the body and mind, or name and form, is the next link. And the simile is some men who are in a boat. And apparently the boat is our body, and the men who are in the boat are aspects of the mind. Different aspects of the mind. And some of you might have heard of the teaching on five aggregates, which is different kind of parts of our experience, which include the body and four different aspects of mind that could be represented in this. So something came to mind when I saw this, and I'm going, three men in a boat. That sounds familiar. Like rub-a-dub-dub. And something, something, something. But there's three men in a boat, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and they're knaves. And then I looked up knaves. One translation of knaves were tricky, deceitful fellows. So these are different sort of aspects of mind that arise, which include things like perception. So the mental factors of feeling and perception arise together with consciousness to create a process by which we create a universe from moment to moment from incoming sense impressions. These are the factors which pick up, define, locate, and react to the data of consciousness. So our entire world is made up of name and form. Just like when, say, we walk around the building and we would start to notice different things depending on different kinds of perceptions and inclinations. And I would just want to mention that there are two important mental factors that can arise here, and where some of these things just seem to be automatic and we have no control over, But there's two that are of that are mental factors that come into play when we start to examine what creates suffering and how do we get out of this. And those are intention and attention. Because we can start to direct our attention in different ways, volitionally or consciously. For example, we could decide, well, I'm going to do some metta practice. I'm going to see if I can develop some aspects of loving kindness as opposed to aversion, or generosity as opposed to greed. So, yeah, is it?
So you can interrupt this chain at any point, is that what you're saying, by doing meta practice, for example?
Yep. You
have to go back to the root to extinguish this.
I think you can interrupt it, and by interrupting it, it does affect the, if you want to call ignorance the root, then it does help to change that, to transform the ignorance. Yeah, but that's a good point. And sometimes it's a little, maybe, I'm not sure about, like, sometimes these things are arising kind of together, just like the example before. So, and other times it seems like one leads to the other to the other. Then we get to what we had talked about a little bit before is contact, when a sense object is encountered by the sense organ and contact is made and consciousness arises, kind of conditioned by all these other mental factors. So that is represented in this picture. There's a couple embracing. Sometimes it's a couple making love. So that'd be a powerful contact with probably some clinging and grasping coming later. So it's through the six sense doors that contact with the world is made. So I kind of see this as, okay, this is actually happening moment to moment to moment right now as we are going through the world. So it's not theoretical. Ah, right. The simile for the six sense doors, which is number five on the... is a building with six windows in it. And sometimes it's represented that there's a monkey inside the building who's kind of jumping from one window to another window, to another window, to another window. But yeah, that's, I like that kind of simile. So the Buddha said, with contact the world arises, and with the cessation of contact the world ceases. This suggests that our world is being created again and again, over and over, without cessation, for our lifetime and maybe more lifetimes. And when we meditate, then we can experience, say our eyes are closed, we don't have so much sight sense. But that now we start to experience all these mental kind of impressions arising. If we've noticed, you know, as thoughts come, as the sixth sense. So moving on to feeling. Now from here, it seems to me it could be and I think it could be interrupted, but it's our normal habits would be kind of like a set of dominoes for the next five links, where we have, well, if we include contact and then feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, it's kind of like, like it's very fast. It's like contact's made, and if there's this base of kind of craving, then it's kind of like, oh, I like that, don't like that, or I'm a little foggy about that. So feeling has a very strong simile here. It seems a little overblown, but it's a person with an arrow sticking in their eye. Ouch. Ouch is right. But maybe the Buddha was trying to make a point here. So feeling, there are three. This is not how we usually refer to feeling with all the emotions and all that. It is a very basic sense of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And these are the forerunners of all these other emotions and mind states and all the rest. And this is an important place to pay attention. As I said, well, contact's actually happening right now. And if we can pay attention with some wisdom, this is the traditional place that the instruction is given that you can break this chain. Yeah, kind of. Yes, before it gets to kind of craving, but it seems to me it's right at the point of contact and feeling arising that then it can. We're not blocking out that it's pleasant or unpleasant. It's kind of like sitting and experiencing maybe a physical discomfort, but then creating a whole sense of worry and mental pain in addition to some physical discomfort that we experience. That's the optional part. Then the craving is we get a little milder here. I can identify with this one. It's just a guy enjoying a cup of tea. So some sensual pleasure, but seems innocent enough, you know. But you know, you drink a cup of tea, it could lead to some harder. Exactly. Don't go down that road. So craving, or sometimes it's called thirst. This is a translation of tanha. And this is in the Four Noble Truths. What is the cause of suffering? It's tanha, craving. And to me, it's kind of like something that is existing already as kind of a deficit. So then there's a deficit, and we come in contact with something, and it's mildly pleasurable. Then we want to go to that because of this sort of deficit position. It's not coming from just a neutral place. Oh, I like that. You know, it's kind of like got more energy behind it. So it is said, a mind filled with craving cannot appreciate anything. I think that's certainly built in. Yeah. So as I said, it's described as an unquenchable thirst or never-ending hunger, and it's represented in the in this depiction of these realms by the hungry ghost realm, where where these beings, these unfortunate beings, cannot get sated. So the Buddha said, Bhikkhus, there is a noble truth concerning the arising of suffering. It arises with craving, a thirst for more that's bound up with delight and passion and is always running here and there, just like that monkey in that house with the six windows, jumping from one to the other. That is, thirst for sense input, thirst to be something, and thirst not to be something. So it's said that there's three types of craving. Craving for sense desire, which we've talked about a bit. Craving for being. Now, sometimes I could see sense desire turning into this craving for being. Like I see something, that's a nice looking car. I could see myself driving that car, or that kind of being. And then the craving for non-being. I don't want to be here, I'm bored, I don't want to feel pain. But the catch here is when we are avoiding that, we can't really attend to the present moment where our life is really happening, and we can't attend to the habits that create our suffering in our lives. And there's a lot of that craving for non-being as well in our society. I see that as, all the different distractions that we have. And you can't walk down the street without listening to some music, so blocking out something out there as well. Or checking your messages, or, doing this, doing that, entertaining oneself. And one way of viewing, like, say, this path or Dharma training is turning tanha, which is this lack or this craving force, into chanda, which is a healthy desire, which is more based on clear seeing. Tanha is a reflex, chanda is a choice. Moving on to clinging, then, we have, here it's a person, I think, grasping for some fruit in a tree, and sometimes it's a monkey grasping for fruit in a tree. But it's turned, so now we've turned this kind of tendency towards this desire into an action. So I saw, I was reading Christina Feldman, and she said, and I think we, probably all experienced this, is a recurring thought in meditation practice. It's kind of this thought comes up, kind of, notice it, go back, comes up again, kind of several times. So she said, well, a thought returning more than once is probably clinging. Unless it's an intentional reflection like metta practice. So something that's we've probably all experienced. So the craving has solidified, it's turned into an activity. And I'll just give one example here. I heard of a program a few years ago of somebody was bringing Jewish Israeli teenagers to a camp in Maine, and also Palestinian teenagers to the same camp to see if they could kind of learn from each other and develop some tolerance. And from this point, they had never their usual way, they would never encounter each other. They were always the enemy to, the other was always the enemy. So you can imagine this would have been a very challenging situation. And I just remember one thing from this interview that they said, well, and they would go through all kinds of different exercises with these teens, and they're in a natural environment and different things. Kind of, what if you could kind of point to the single most effective thing that you saw was useful in these people, these two different groups having some understanding of each other, what would it be? And then she said, well, if they could learn to let the other person finish their sentence before they spoke. And I thought that was kind of before that kind of clinging to, and this is one type of clinging to a point of view. And of course we have all kinds of views. Or we can flip through the newspaper and see all kinds of views, and all kinds of suffering coming out of the attachment to views. So that would be one type of clinging to view. There's other clingings to sense desire, clinging to the sense of I, clinging to self. So the Buddha said, even so, monks, whatever isn't yours, let go of it. And letting go of it will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. And what isn't yours? Form isn't yours. Feeling isn't yours. Perception isn't yours. Fabrication isn't yours. Consciousness isn't yours. Let go of it. Your letting go of it will be for your long-term welfare and happiness. There he's referring to the five aggregates, which are kind of a way of designating the self. So we're almost there, almost made it around. Here we've got, there's a couple of, I think on that version there, it's a pregnant woman. Here it seems like a couple engaged in making love, and I think the pregnant woman, so the sense of self is becoming stronger. I like the kind of the pregnant woman because there was a sort of progression. The sense of self is becoming stronger and our life is starting to take certain directions, and because we live in a certain way, we make karma according to that way of living. So there's some kind of parallels to this part of the circle to the formations, to making volitional formations, it seems to me. And when we live in a certain way and produce the corresponding karma, and the sense of self is getting more and more solidified, then the next link is birth, and that's a mother giving birth to a baby. And here, with the next two links, we have the next link is birth from craving, and then we get to death. So it seems to me that this could be kind of a little loop just itself representing samsara, birth and death, like a little loop by itself. So through birth, we experience what all beings must experience. These are the messengers that Yama referred to. Old age, sickness, death, all the suffering that comes with existence. And then we have the next link, which is death. And that simile is someone carrying an old person on their back. And actually, in this simile here, it's actually carrying a corpse on their back because they are carrying them towards a flame, a pyre, funeral pyre of fire. And there's a little, often this phrase is used, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. So apart from physical death, death also refers to the disappearance of any mental or physical experience. So the passing away of a state that has come into being. And we experience the conflict or friction which results from our solid state of becoming, of coming up against the impermanent nature of the world. So if we have a version of ourselves that's permanent, and we come up against the impermanent nature of the world, there's suffering and stress involved there. And I've heard from a couple of different places. So I'll, the next link is the where we started, is with ignorance. So what makes sense to me, and I've heard Ajahn Sona talk about this and another teacher talk about this. So what comes between this kind of link of death, old age, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And how might that contribute to then this ignorance, which is now the next link, is... So it makes sense that we have a 12.5 link in here, and it's called hindrances, the five hindrances. And when we experience those hindrances, we're actually connecting into the very central energy of greed, hatred, delusion. Those are the manifestation, the five hindrances, which would be aversion, desire, what's called sloth and torpor, restlessness, and then doubt would be manifestations of these three animals in the center of greed, hatred, and delusion. And if we think about when we are caught in that any particular hindrance, our sense of self has gotten to be pretty strong. And the there is a conflict with what is and what we think should be. And so what do we do? And in in some of the depictions, and I think in that depiction there's actually a path leading out of the human realm, and there's a Buddha figure who's pointing. And if you follow where the Buddha is pointing to the opposite side. So on the very upper right-hand side, there's a Buddha figure pointing, and on the top left side is a picture. It's a depiction of the Eightfold Path, almost like a wagon wheel with eight spokes. So the Eightfold Path is the practice we undertake to remove the hindrances. I'll just finish here with a quote from Ajahn Suchito about the hindrances. And this may be a different perspective on how we practice, because we might have started practicing thinking, well, you know, maybe I can sit and feel a little better and, you know, get a little... But then the hindrances will sooner or later arise, and then how do we deal with those? So this is Ajahn Suchito on the hindrances. The hindrances are the nitty-gritty of meditation. One comment I'd like to make is that they are nothing personal, even though they scream that this is what you are. Then I'd also add that clearing them will change your life. The Buddha likened the effect of clearing the hindrances to that of getting out of jail. When these are cleared, your mind easily concentrates, and the wisdom that has been operating in every path factor can penetrate deeply into the matrix of unknowing, it's referring to ignorance, and of craving. So I think we've gone on a long time on this these teachings. Is there any comments or questions at this point? Yeah, on the back of the our diagram are a list of all the links. The Pali, the English, and a short explanation of each of the links. So you can check that out.
This might be related more to what you're going to be talking about this afternoon, but as I was sitting here, I thought, just by us engaging in meditation, we really are working at going against this. So. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah.
Our minds are the simile of the well-made or the poorly made pots.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to cultivate minds that are at least moving towards well-made.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. The Buddhist teachings is kind of like, well, there's the bad news and the good news. We looked at some of the bad news here, and. But this afternoon, we'll look at some of the good news. So thank you for your attention. And so we'll have, it's around almost 12:30 now, so we'll take a break until 1:30 with lunch. We'll go back into silence, have a silent lunch period. And you know, this is a rich day, rich opportunity to be present with all our experiences, including eating. So, could someone volunteer to ring the bell at, say, 1:25? Helen? Yeah? Okay, thanks. Maybe just walk around the building and ring the bell. Great. So, we'll see you back here at 1:30 and again in the afternoon, we'll have some periods of practice and some periods of teaching, and so we'll experience kind of going back and forth into